Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. April 8th, 2017. And you know, it's been one of those weeks again. I mean, they just keep on coming. We're going to be going over a whole bunch of stuff this morning. It is early morning in Wyoming, USA. And boy, another action-packed week. Unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. I think I told you some time ago that President Trump would not be boring, and he certainly is not. Here's what we're going to cover this morning, because we got a lot, so I'm going to get right to it. First of all, I'm going to tell you a little story, a little history story, which I think you'll find really interesting. Then we're going to go over some revelations about the Clinton Podesta ties to Russia. You know, if you type that in the search bar, you'll see that I've talked about that before. The real collusion here, folks, is the Democratic Party, Clinton, Podesta, and Obama with Russia. That's the real deal. And I wouldn't be surprised if all this trumped-up Russia shit, besides trying to delegitimize Donald Trump and try and waylay his agenda and whatever, isn't kind of some CYA on what they had to do with Russia. Anyway, if you type that in the search bar, you can hear some details on the Clinton-Podesta stuff, and some new ones emerged this week. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Then, of course, we're going to be talking about the revelations concerning our friend Susan Rice. Lying liar. You know, the entire Obama administration were lying liars. She was probably the lying liar-in-chief other than Barry himself. And of course, Valerie was smart enough to stay in the background, his Iranian handler. In any event, we're going to be talking about that today and some points that I don't think you've really heard. Some dots, number one, and number two, the connection of those dots that you've not heard from other media. We're also going to be talking, as I promised last week, we're going to be talking about what illegal immigration costs your state. We're probably not going to have time to go through every state, but I'm going to pick 8, 9, 10 of them where I have lots and lots and lots of listeners, and thank you, listeners. And your eyeballs are going to pop. You know, all this crapola from the progressives, from the alt-left and the Democrats about how the wall and, you know, it's inhumane and it's going to cost too much and we can't afford it. I mean, these are the people who drove us into $10 trillion of new debt over 8 years. Now they're concerned about a couple billion for the wall. When you hear these numbers, here's the bottom line. You build this wall, if it's 50% effective, it'll pay for itself in 1 year just on the savings of state costs. Never mind federal costs. State costs on illegal immigration. This is the story, of course, that nobody is carrying, and I think you'll find it fascinating. I don't know if my producers, we are loaded with articles this week. I mean, loaded. Loads of articles, and they're all great under the various categories on the podcast site. And I don't know if they had time or room to get this entire article up. It's interactive. You can actually click on your state, and you can see all the stats. If it's not up this week, it will absolutely be up next week for you. In the meantime, we'll be going over it this morning. So, the other things that we're going to go over this morning is some Sanctuary City stuff. I got four little vignettes to tell you about this lunacy concerning sanctuary cities. Of course, it ties right into the illegal immigration, illegal alien costs. And then if we have time, and I don't mean to be a downer, because this has been a great week for Trump, and conservatives in a whole bunch of respects. But there are some things you need to keep a look at, keep your eye on in terms of economy, because it will affect your pocketbook and your family. Okay, let's get started. Number one, a real quick little story. You know, I've talked about globalism and populist nationalism before, which is really what this election was all about. It was really what Brexit was all about. You can type it in the search bar, globalism, listen to those shows. In one show, I describe what globalism is, which nobody seems to have been able to do up to that time. And so, you know, one of the most globalistic outfits on the planet is the European Union, where you have an unelected bunch of bureaucrats in Brussels sending out regulation. They're kind of the social EPA of Europe. I mean, you know, they regulate everything. They have a rule for everything. It's one of the reasons England is leaving, France may leave, Italy, the Quirinal vote about 5 months ago was basically a rejection of the European Union. And the head European Union guy is a putz globalist who, you know, Obama got along with him. Great, of course. But he has just been very upset with Donald Trump and Brexit and all sorts of things because it's interfering with his globalistic collective dream. And he threatened to try and start some shenanigans that would get the states in the United States to separate from the United States because the United States was supporting separation of countries from the European Union. Anyway, the guy's name, Juncker. J-U-N-C-K-E-R. Unfortunately, he has several years left on his term. And his first name, of course, is Jean-Claude. Jean-Claude Juncker. Yeah. President of the European Commission. And he has complained bitterly this week about Donald Trump's support for the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union. Oh, cry me a river. Anyway, after he came out with this, I'm going to... Here's his quote, because you can't make this stuff up. If he's talking about Trump, goes on like that, I'm going to promote the independence of Ohio and Austin, Texas, in the United States of America, unquote. Ted Cruz responded beautifully. I think petty jabs from European leaders are not helpful. He was talking to the European, to the Washington Examiner. And my simple message to Juncker is, don't mess with Texas. I love it. I just love it. Anyway, Juncker has other problems, folks. The EU, European Union, favorability in member countries is like dropping like a stone. Of course, England has voted to leave. France may very well vote to leave. They have important elections coming up. Quirinal voted to, not to leave, but to reject. And Greece, of course, is thinking of leaving also. But basically, all the countries who now look at the EU as being unfavorable, and these are member countries of the EU, there's, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, Poland, and the United Kingdom. In fact, the EU guy from Poland, right before Ted Cruz kind of took his don't mess with Texas stance with Juncker, he criticized Juncker, the Polish guy did, for his behavior while meeting with Pope Francis. And I can't pronounce the name, so excuse me, folks, but Christina Polowitz, something like that, Polowitz. The Polish member of Parliament said Juncker's, quote, obvious alcohol dependency, unquote, has made him, quote, a problem of the entire European community. Quote, particularly distasteful and out of place was your behavior during the last audience with Pope Francis. You know, you got to love it. All right, now, how about a little story here from Wyoming, a little history lesson, because it's fascinating. So, on April 3rd, that was Monday, on that day in 1954, there was kind of a strange and ironic meeting. The Secretary of State stood up to address kind of a secret but bipartisan meeting of eight of the key people in Congress at that time in 1954. The Secretary of State's name was John Foster Dulles, and the president at that time was President Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower. Dulles told the congressman that France was on the verge of losing its war with the communist guerrillas in Indochina, i.e. Vietnam. And he laid out a proposal for a quick military strike that would help the French, it would change the war, it would bottle up communism, would do all these great things. And, of course, these key folks in Congress, they saw the logic, they saw the opportunity, but they had questions. Would we aid the French without United Nations approval? Would we undertake this action unilaterally without a bunch of allies? And the Senate Minority Leader, April 3rd, 1954, was a Democrat. And he said that he would not come along and go with the plan without a UN resolution or a cluster of allies. Gee, have we heard this before? I mean, did you hear all the comments about the... I mean, mostly there was approval, but there were a number of congressmen, including Rand Paul. I mean, Rand, read the Constitution. You don't know what you're talking about. Who said, we should have formed a coalition, and we should have talked about, he should have come to Congress, and we should have debated it. And, oh, yeah, well, that's a great surprise attack. Let's debate it in Congress for 2 weeks and then go out and do the missile strike. I mean, how do these people get elected? Well, who of my listeners out there have voted for these morons? Raise your hand. Please don't do it again. In any event, back to our story, our little history lesson here, which, by the way, I'm going to try and do in all the shows. People really liked my stories the last few weeks that I start the show off with, so I think I'm going to make that maybe a staple of On the Right Side. So anyway, the Senate Minority Leader did this Democratic thing, you know, if we don't have the UN and we don't have a coalition and blah, 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 we're not going to do it. Anyway, neither France nor Dulles could persuade the UN. Gee, Russian veto. Does that sound familiar? Oh, yeah, the Russian veto. And they couldn't get a coalition together. The Senate Minority Leader opted out. No military move occurred. Now, 10 years later, that Senate leader, that minority Democratic Senate leader, whose name was Lyndon Baines Johnson, had become the president. He poured hundreds of thousands of troops and munitions into Indochina, Vietnam, in a vain attempt to regain an initiative that had been lost. Does this sound familiar? The Mideast? ISIS? Syria? History does repeat itself, folks. A little history lesson for you this Saturday morning from the hinterlands of Wyoming. Now, let's talk about absolutely despicable, should be behind bars wearing an orange pantsuit along with Hillary and Barry and a whole bunch of other people, Susan Rice. Now, when I say she's a lying liar, number one, you remember the Benghazi video. Number two, you remember her coming out for Bergdahl and saying again on Five Sunday shows, he served with honor and distinction. And, you know, if you watch her do these interviews, she's absolutely earnest, or should we say faking being earnest. She looks serious. She looks in the camera. She speaks without hesitation. You know, I mean, Yeah, okay. Burt Bergdahl. Now being tried for treason and desertion. Served with honor and distinction. You know, perhaps in Susan Rice's mind, that is honor and distinction, given her disdain for things American. Just like her bosses, Valerie Jarrett and Barry Obama. And then you remember that she and John Kerry and Barry Obama came out and told us what a great job they had done getting all the chemical weapons out of Syria. I mean, she went on all the Sunday talk shows and talked about how all, and there's a key word in here, all the declared weapons had been removed in their agreement with Russia. Declared. Okay. And then John Kerry came out like that same, within those same few days, and talked about how 100%, that's his exact words, you can Google it up, 100% of the weapons had been removed. And then Barry himself, in an interview, I forget who it was with, you can Google it up, he talked about how brilliant they were, how they averted any military stuff, and how, in reality, even though people were on his butt, he had really enforced the red line through diplomacy because all the chemical weapons had been removed. Well, that is 1,500 deaths ago. All such deaths and thousands more injured for life due to the use of chemical weapons that had been 100% removed, that had all the declared were gone, that were all gone. Susan Rice again, yet again. And then, of course, and I talked about this last week, we have her, I believe it was March 22nd. You can look it up. You can Google it up. Susan Rice, PBS interview, March 2017. Listen to her yourself talking about how she just didn't know what Congressman Nunes was talking about. And, oh, I mean, what is all this? I'm just a mushroom in the dark. Well, you know, now we have all sorts of stuff coming out. Some of it just yesterday, in fact, on Friday. So, number one, she was the national security advisor to Barack Obama. The only person closer to Barack Obama is Valerie Jarrett. And the troika of the three of them, with Ben Rhodes writing the script, are the ones who foisted all these lies on us. And they were lies at the time they were stated. In other words, these people knew the crapola they were feeding us was absolutely false. Now, it's kind of worrisome if you extend that over to the Iran deal, which nobody ever really saw. Because if that crapola was false, and we already know that it was, that means that the United States is at risk of a nuclear attack in the relatively near future by the mullahs. Unless, of course, Donald Trump does something about it. I personally think that he will. In any event, Susan Rice, after saying she didn't know anything about it, found out that, and I'm going to quote here, these are former U.S. attorneys and two White House National Security Council, NSC, veterans. Quote, former President Barack Obama's National Security Advisor Susan Rice ordered U.S. spy agencies to produce detailed spreadsheets of legal phone calls involving Donald Trump and his aides when he was running for president. This is according to U.S. Attorney Joseph DeGenova. What was produced by the intelligence community at the request of Mrs. Rice were detailed spreadsheets of intercepted phone calls with unmasked Trump associates in perfectly legal conversations. Rice ordered U.S. spy agencies to produce detailed spreadsheets of legal phone calls, blah, blah, blah. Quote, what was produced by the intelligence community at the request of Mrs. Rice were detailed spreadsheets Let's skip down here. The overheard conversations involved no illegal activity by anybody, any of the Trump associates, or anyone they were speaking with. In short, the only apparent illegal activity was the unmasking of the people in the calls. Another gentleman, Colonel retired, James Warashuk, also an NSC veteran, former director for intelligence for the U.S. Central Command, told the Daily Caller News Foundation that many hands, I quote, that many hands had to be involved throughout the Obama administration to launch such a political spying campaign, unquote. We're looking at a potential constitutional crisis from the standpoint that we use an extremely strong capability, and that's a felony. And you can get 10 years for that. It's a tremendous abuse of the system. We're not supposed to be monitoring American citizens. Bigger than the crime, it is the breach of public trust. All right. By the way, it's also a breach, folks, of the constitutional liberties afforded all Americans under the Fourth Amendment. And I think it stands, shall we say, in really... I mean, it's a bright light in terms of the existence of the deep state and Obama's shadow government. Because the other thing that we learned this week is that the NSA, who collected the intelligence, passed it on to the CIA. If you go back about, might be 8-10 weeks ago, I told you it was the CIA that was doing the dirty work here. And the reason I knew that is because all you had to do was watch the bitter rancor with which John Brennan left his post when Donald Trump was elected. I mean, he didn't just resign. He went on 5 Sunday talk shows and talked about, you know, how bad Donald Trump was and what a terrible day for America and blah, 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 blah. Well, the bottom line is Brennan is in this up to his eyeballs. He may even be one of the leakers. If you've listened to my past shows, you can type in the search bar, Brennan, John Brennan, CIA. The shows will come up. You will hear me talk about the fact that there is some dispute. I'm going to sneeze here. Excuse me, listeners. There is some dispute about whether or not John Brennan is a Muslim. Based on all the evidence I have seen, you can Google it up yourself. He did convert to Islam in 2009 in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Maybe that's one of the reasons that he was maybe that's one of the reasons he was appointed by Barry. Who knows? Anyway, Susan Rice and CIA Director Brennan unmasked the names of the Trump associates. We've also come to find out that there was a complete log of all this kept. It was discovered by an underling, believe it or not, in Trump's National Security Council, who was trying to clean up the computer mess that Susan Rice's National Security Council had left. And he, being a bright young lad, the minute he found it, he knew what it was. He went to the White House counsel, and from there, it was handled completely properly. You know, I said this when he did it, but Donald Trump's tweet that everybody got all over him with, and he was premature, and he was stupid, and it was dumb, and blah, 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 was brilliant. It was brilliant. It single-handedly changed the entire context of this Russia-Trump nonsense. And instead, the focus now is on the Obama administration. Have you noticed that Barry has disappeared from the scene? Have we heard a peep out of Barry or Valerie for weeks and weeks and weeks? No, we haven't. That in itself is telltale. And Susan Rice is in a world of hurt, folks. And I think John Brennan right behind her, Ben Rhodes right behind her, and who knows, Valerie Jarrett. And I think Loretta Lynch. On my previous reports to you, It seems that Loretta Lynch signed the FISA warrants. And Loretta Lynch gave information to that gal who's going to be testifying shortly on the Hill. I forget her name right now. Kate, I believe, who was the acting attorney general. This is the gal who refused to enforce Trump's order and that Trump fired. But it seems that she had access to all this information with unmasked American names. Anyway, it's all a convoluted story. But the bottom line is that Susan Rice was the focal point for, number one, the request for information, the request for spying, the unmasking of the names in conspiracy with others, such as John Brennan, etc., and then the distribution of that information illegally. Its gathering was also illegal, by the way. I don't, you know, you've heard all this crap about, oh, it's legal, and it's, and it was, you know, incidental, and it was a, it was in concert of our monitoring of foreign officials. Listen, that may be true for some of it, but here's, I'm going to, I've predicted this correctly so far, unlike most in the media. I think only Mark Levin and Sean Hannity have gotten this right, along with myself, and that is, let me tell you what I think is going to happen here. Number one, Susan Rice is going down. Ben Rhodes is going down. Brennan is likely going down. If they can prove any linkage, if they can prove Barack Obama knew or read this intelligence or had anything to do with its ordering, or Valerie Jarrett, they're going down too. And you know what? Couldn't happen to a nicer crew. Hopefully Hillary will go down for her server stuff, but, you know, that remains to be seen. But those five individuals, along with Farkas, I talked about her last week. This is the defense intelligence analyst who stupidly went on MSNBC and admitted to all this crap right a week before Susan Rice has kind of unveiled herself. We're also going to find out, I'm going to make that this prediction right now. We're going to find out that there was surveillance of American-to-American conversations. In other words, some of this surveillance, excuse me again, some of this, I'm getting cold, I think. Some of this surveillance was absolutely American-to-American, not incidental collection of an American talking to a foreigner, but American-to-American. And you will find, because it's already come out, I think it was Thursday of this past week, that the intelligence collected and disseminated was not just conversations between Americans and foreign officials. It was actually personal details about the daily lives of some of these unmasked Americans. Absolutely, positively illegal. There's lots more to come on this story, folks. This is going to be really interesting. And my thought is that somebody in the five or six people that are going to be going down on this, I don't know if it's Farkas or Rice or Rhodes or Brennan or who knows who, somebody is going to turn rat to save their hide. Think about Ben Rhodes. He's 26 or 27 years old. I don't think he wants to spend the next 50 years of his life in jail. And we already know he has no morals, no scruples, no loyalty, and that he lies through his teeth. You know, that makes for a pretty good rat. And with a rat, you can catch the kingpins. That's how they do it in law enforcement. All right. Some more information. So, if you remember the WikiLeaks release, Vault 7 it was called, it now seems that at least some of this Russia-Trump BS collusion, some of this stuff was actually instigated by the CIA itself and then made to look like Russian communications or Russian links to various servers at Trump Tower, etc. And everybody wondered why the Russians were so clumsy and so inept to leave their footprints when all this digital tracking. Well, that's pretty easy, because the Russians didn't do it. The CIA did it under Mr. Brennan and Mr. Obama and Ms. Rice and Mr. Rhodes. And that's why it was quote-unquote sloppy. A clear trail had to be left to make it look like it was the Russians. I'm telling you, there's a lot of stuff that's going to be coming out of this. I'm gonna read you a quote from the DC Thinker. Needless to say, that explains how the alleged Russian hackers could be so clumsy as to leave obvious and damning fingerprints on their work. So it is probable that the Russians were clumsy because they weren't actually Russians. They were undoubtedly CIA operatives from the center. Okay, so some more information for you on this. So the NBC News, this was on March 31st, actually. NBC News is the outfit that interviewed Evelyn Farkas, during which she said, remember what I was talking about now with the rats jumping out. At least one rat is going to jump off the sinking ship. Quote, it wasn't clear to me that the White House was keeping them, she's talking about Democratic congressmen, in the loop. The White House wasn't keeping them in the loop. Ha. Yep, this is going to get interesting, folks. Interesting. Now, more information has come out on Susan Rice and the conspiracy to break all sorts of federal laws, abridge Americans' Fourth Amendment rights, and basically weaponize, turn on its head, the sanctity of the American intelligence community for political ends. Okay. I'm going to quote here something for you. Fox News and Bloomberg News, both of them, and Bloomberg is hardly right, folks. In fact, I think you could say pretty safely they're kind of left. On Monday of this past week, that's, what, 5 days ago, 6 days ago, citing multiple sources, both of the news agencies came out and reported that Rice, I'm reading now, had requested the intelligence information that was produced in a highly organized operation. Boy, that ties into what these other guys said, huh? Fox said the unmasked names of Trump aides were given to officials at the National Security Council, that's Rice, Rhodes, etc., and the White House, the Department of Defense, James Clapper, Obama's Director of National Intelligence, and John Brennan, Obama's CIA Director. Joining Rice in the alleged White House operations was her deputy, Ben Rhodes. See, we just keep hearing the same names. Like, you know, the spears are coming in from all directions and they all have the same target. Imagine that. Michael Duran, he's also a former National Security Council Senior Director. Quote, somebody blew a hole in the wall between national security secrets and partisan politics. There was a stream of information that was supposed to be hermetically sealed from politics, and the Obama administration found a way to blow a hole in that wall. This is a leaking of signal intelligence. That means two things. Number one, it's top secret because of the way they got it. And number two, that means it is unrefined. It is whatever gossip, rumor, innuendo they happen to pick up that is then compiled into a report. That's not how it's done. Basically, intelligence agencies pick up all sorts of gossip, rumor, and innuendo. That's what they do. They then ferret through it to find the nuggets and the facts. And their reports are cleansed of all the nonsense and just bear down on the facts. That is not what this was, because that's not what it was about. Quote, the surveillance is the responsibility of the National Security Agency. They have to abide by this guidance when one of the other agencies say, we're looking at this particular person which we would like to unmask. The lawyers and counsel at the NSA surely would be talking to the lawyers and members of the counsel at CIA. Ah, Mr. Brennan. Or at the National Security Council. Oh, Ms. Rice. Or at the Director of National Intelligence. Oh, Mr. Clapper. Or at the FBI. Hi, Mr. Comey. It's unbelievable of the level and degree of the administration to look for information on Donald Trump and his associates, his campaign team, and his transition team. This is really, really serious stuff. Unquote. And then he goes on, that's a felony, and you can get 10 years for each count. It's a tremendous abuse of the system. We're not supposed to be monitoring American citizens. So, folks, why don't we say things are kind of closing in. By the way, the story was broken by a guy by the name of Eli Lake early this week, and it was on Bloomberg, not Fox, not anywhere else. It was on Bloomberg. Quote, the pattern of Rice's request was discovered in a National Security Council review of the government's policy on unmasking the identities of individuals in the U.S. who are not targets of electronic eavesdropping, but whose communications are collected incidentally. Normally, those names are redacted from summaries of monitored conversations and appear in reports as something like, quote, U.S. Person 1, unquote. The kid who discovered this, his name is Ezra Cohen Watnick. In February, Ezra, baby, good job, kid, discovered Rice's multiple requests to unmask U.S. persons in intelligence reports that related to Trump transition activities. This is after the election, folks. He brought this to the attention of the White House General Counsel's office, who reviewed more of Rice's requests and instructed Ezra to end his own research into the unmasking policy. He was getting that sensitive, in other words. So, I have a bunch of articles posted on this, and there's a bunch of videos you might want to watch. Nobody had to go into Trump Tower, folks, and install a wiretapping device. Donald Trump's quote with wiretapping in quotes, i.e. wiretapping was just a terminology he was using, was brilliant. And he obviously already had this information because it was unmasked in January and February. His quote, his tweet was in March. And he handled it just right. He didn't come out and say what it was, breach national security, or, you know, he just kind of teed it off, so to speak. Teed it off. Let me quote from this article again, by the way. This is from the D.C. Clothesline. Quote, intelligence sources said the logs discovered by the National Security Council staff, that's Ezra, suggested Rice's interest in the NSA materials, some of which included unmasked American identities, appeared to begin, listen to this, last July, around the time Trump secured the GOP nomination. Gee, folks, you think that was a coincidence? And accelerated after Trump's election in November launched a transition that continued through January. Quote, most, if not all, had nothing to do with the Russian election interference scandal. Huh. Quote, the NSA can legally intercept foreigners' conversations without court permission under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That's FISA. You guys have all heard of that before. But it cannot target Americans' conversations overseas. If an American is accidentally intercepted or two foreigners are caught talking about an American. That name is supposed to be redacted in intelligence reports and replaced by a description, just like the last source I gave you, a description like, quote, U.S. citizen number one. You know, folks, you tie all this together with what Obama was doing, his allowing all this, the declaring of elections as national infrastructure, which then gave him the authority to expand where all these source reports went to. Not real intelligence reports, source reports, rumor, gossip, innuendo, etc. From three agencies to 17, from, you know, a handful of people to hundreds. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are no coincidences. It's no wonder Barry is so friggin' quiet the past few weeks. He's probably on the horn talking to Susan, Ben, Farkas, who knows who, saying, you know, just keep your mouth shut and we'll take care of you. Yeah, I can almost visualize the conversation right now. Or maybe Valerie Jarrett's making the calls for him. Who knows? Oh, there's one thing I did want to talk about this morning, too, which I forgot to even mention in my opening. That is voter fraud. And I'm going to talk about that in just a minute, because guess what? Trump was right about that also. The first really definitive study over improper voting rolls has now come out. I'll be back to that in a moment. Let me finish up with this treasonous, this discourse on treasonous activity by the Obama administration, and I mean from Barry on down, okay? It appears that the deep state and Barry's entrenched shadow government is resisting the attempts by Congress, both the House and the Senate Intel Committees, is resisting turning over documents they promised, this is the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, to turn over. So far, this is what's been uncovered by those committees. Number one, surveillance targeting the Trump team during the Obama administration began last July when Donald Trump won the nomination. Number two, the spying on the Trump team had nothing to do with the collection of foreign intelligence or an investigation into Russia or any of that crap. Nothing to do with it. I'm telling you, just like I said at the beginning of the show, we are going to find out that there were ordered intercepts. Absolutely illegal. Never mind distribution. Never mind unmasking. There were ordered intercepts, which were carried out by either NSA or CIA, or the NSA at CIA's request, John Brennan, of American-to-American conversations. And there was surveillance of people on the Trump campaign team and the Trump transition team, down to the minute details of their daily life. This is going to be a huge deal. It's already a huge deal. Number three, the spying was done purely for political purposes that, quote, have nothing to do with national security and everything to do with hurting and embarrassing Trump and his team. Number four, the person who did the unmasking was someone, quote, very well known, very high up, very senior in the intelligence world, and is not in the FBI. Gee, that only leaves like three people. The admiral who's in charge of the NSA, we're pretty sure he didn't do it because he's the only intelligence chief to go visit Trump and try and, you know, establish a working relationship. I don't think Clapper did it. This is just my personal opinion. I mean, Clapper is a dirty liar. You know, he's the guy who sat there in Congress and said, well, you know, we don't collect any information on Americans, at least not wittingly. No, it was Brennan, folks. It was Brennan. That's what we're going to find out. That is exactly what we're going to find out. Number five, congressional investigators know the name of at least one person who was unmasking names. Number six, the initial surveillance on the Trump team led to a number of names. This wasn't just Flynn. This wasn't just Sessions. It wasn't just Trump. A number of names. Number seven, the House Intelligence Committee has known about the unmasking since January. Number eight, two sources in the intelligence community, this is in addition to the sources I've already given you this morning, told Nunes who did the unmasking and told him at least one of the names of someone in the Trump team who was unmasked. They also, this is really important, gave Nunes the serial numbers of the classified reports that documented the unmasking. Remember, folks, there's a complete digital log of all this stuff. People are going to go down for this, and they well should. It's a shame, and I hope they are tried in jurisdictions that have no limit on the penalties that can be imposed for treason. Number nine, it took Nunes, who, by the way, I guess you know is temporarily, although it's probably permanent, stepped down from the chairmanship of the House Intel Committee. He's going to remain on the committee, but he's no longer the chairman. That's a good thing. I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you why in just a moment. It took Nunes a couple of weeks to figure out how to see those intelligence reports. What a big surprise. Intelligence agencies were stonewalling him and not allowing the chairman, etc., to see them. Number 10. There was only two places that Nunes could have seen the information. Either where the sources work, which would have blown their cover, and that's the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, on the White House grounds, which houses the National Security Council and has computers linked to the secure system containing the reports. So now we know why Nunes had to go to the White House to get this information. We also know that Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intel Committee, went over there. I don't know if you saw interviews of him this week, but he was glum. And he was terse. And, you know, Adam Schiff is usually, you know, I don't like the guy, but he's well-polished. He's a great progressive spokesman. He knows exactly how to lie, exactly what to say. He does great at covering his discourse in non-political terms, even though it's highly political. And he generally looks fresh as a daisy. If you watch his interview, this was the day of Nunes' resignation. I believe that was Wednesday. I mean, there's so much stuff happening, you lose track of which day it happened, and we're only a week between shows. He looks terrible. And on Tuesday, he had gone over to see this information that Nunes already had. So, I am sure the Dems are in damage control mode. If you couple that with the glaring spotlight now on the failed Syria policy, the lies that Barry, Valerie, Susan, and John Kerry, pathetic John Kerry, told us about the Syrian nerve gas stockpiles, and the, shall we say, refreshment of our memory of Obama's red line nonsense back in 2012. I mean, all this is coming quickly to a head. Quickly to a head. Anyway, the documents were circulated at the highest levels of government. There were dozens of documents with information about Trump officials. These documents were not, I'm just giving you random quotes here, folks. I think you're getting the message. And all these different reports from all these different sources tie in. That's my point. The reports are not easily obtainable since they aren't the finished intelligence products that Congress usually gets to see. To quote, to sum up, Team Obama was spying broadly on the incoming administration, unquote. All right. And I'll give you one more question. Or one more, should we say, quote. Farkas, if you remember, in the NBC, this is the defense intelligence analyst who kind of blew everybody's cover just days before Rice was uncovered in her MSNBC interview. At that time, she claimed the information was about Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. In other words, their cover story. Okay. However, just a few days after that interview, the intelligence chiefs who had seen the classified information we're talking about, this includes Obama's own former director of national intelligence, that's James Clapper, and former acting CIA director Michael Morell, who's a pretty stand-up guy, said, quote, have seen no evidence of collusion between the Trump team and the Russian government. Anyway, that is what I have for you on, what should we call it? Yeah, we could call it Obamagate, that's kind of old and tired. We could call it Ricegate, that sounds like a new cereal. Why don't we call it Spygate? It's Spygate. That's what we'll call it from now on, Spygate. Now, I'm going to digress from the schedule here for just a moment. Let me tell you about this illegal votes cast study. This came out Friday, March 31st. Trump, my friends, was right. And so was your humble reporter here. I told you that there were 4 to 5 million illegal votes cast in this last election, and that Trump, if you took out all the illegal votes, never mind the fact you just take out 2 counties in California, if you took out all the illegal votes, Trump won the popular vote as well as the electoral vote. In fact, the electoral vote was probably understated because illegal votes switched a few states. Well, this study that just came out is by J. Christian Adams. Quote, dead people are voting. It's something the Obama administration never wanted to do anything about. They must have liked it. They must have liked who they are voting for. Now we have 4 million ineligible and dead voters on American voter rolls. And that is according to the Pew, P-E-W, Pew Charitable Trust. In Texas, they had a case, just to cite a few, where someone was on the voter rolls who had died in 1944, folks. 1944. He also talked about how during the Bush administration, George Bush, they had tried to get these voter rolls purged and cleaned up and made legal. But that, like the day Obama walked in the Oval Office, he shut that all down. Gee, I wonder why. And the other thing that he brings up in the study is that the Obama administration absolutely wouldn't go after voter fraud. Think about it. I'm pretty sure there was not a federal prosecution through the Obama administration of a single case of voter fraud in 8 years. Not a single case. Pretty interesting. All right. Let us talk about immigration. Because we're going to be talking about the Susan Rice stuff, I think, pretty often. Now, one of the things I have to do, because this is interactive, I have to bring up this deal, and I am not the fastest on a computer, and unfortunately the computer timed out while I was yakking about all this other unbelievable stuff. So bear with me as I bring this up, and we're going to talk about... We're going to talk about, folks, number one, the refugee stuff, even at the reduced rates, because his refugee policy, his travel ban, temporary travel ban, has been blocked thus far. But illegal aliens, sanctuary cities, and... refugees, just those three things. We're not talking about illegal aliens throughout the states, just in these sanctuary cities, and just in the largest ones, are costing $4 billion a year. That's what they're costing American taxpayers. Hempstead in Nassau County, this is in New York, is a sanctuary jurisdiction. The mayor of Hempstead, Wayne J. Hall Sr., said last February, quote, President Trump's recent executive orders go against the moral fiber which our great nation was built, and I wholeheartedly support New York Mayor Bill de Blasio and countless other mayors throughout the United States in denouncing these acts. You know, it's called federal law. Denouncing these acts. I, Mayor de Blasio, and leaders from many other communities throughout the country will work together to oppose these executive orders and protect the rights of all people. Well, how about protecting the rights of American citizens? All right. Rahm Emanuel. Okay. Chicago was built on the back of immigrants, and our future is hitched to the wagon of immigrants, so on and so forth. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said his city's policies are, quote, designed to keep our residents safe. By the way, the day after he said that, there was a California woman who was killed in a car crash caused by a drunk illegal alien with a long rap sheet who had been previously deported. So, nice job, Eric. Great job. Travis County, Texas, Sheriff Sally Hernandez, known as Sanctuary Sally. Okay. She's in defiance of federal and Texas law enforcement, and Texas is going to come down on her. Wait. You wait and see on that one. She's going to wind up behind bars. Quote, we can't have state and elected officials in the state like Sanctuary City down here in Travis County turn a blind eye to releasing illegals that have felony convictions and then wonder what's going to happen when they get back into the general population. That was Senator Paul Betancourt from Texas. Illegal aliens, folks, make up approximately 3.5% of our entire national population. In other words, 11 to 12 million folks. You've heard all this crapola from the left. Oh, sanctuary cities are safer than cities that aren't sanctuary cities, and you know, if you start deporting people, then other people won't turn the criminals in, and sanctuary cities have less crime, and this is all lies. I mean, it's absolutely lies. Complete and utter fabrications. And they know it. Here's the real stats. So 3.5% of the nation's entire population are illegal aliens. According to the U.S. Sentencing Commission, I think that's a fairly reliable source. It's from the government, so if anything, they would certainly lean toward illegal aliens, because that's what Obama put in place. Their study for all of 2015, that's just a year ago, illegal immigrants, remember, they're only 3.5% of the entire nation's population, were responsible for 30.2% of convictions for kidnapping and hostage taking. 17.8% of convictions for drug trafficking, 11.6% of convictions for fraud, 10.4% of convictions for money laundering, 6.1% of convictions for assault, and 5.5% of convictions for murder. So, would you say that the fact that illegal aliens are just a much safer bunch of people than average Americans, would you, what would you call that? Fake news would be kind. How about total BS? By the way, everybody's talking about, oh, well, you know, you can't arrest mayors of sanctuary city. Let me tell you something, folks. That's more BS. Right now, it is federal law, quote, that harboring or shielding from detection any alien who remains in the United States in violation of law is itself a violation of federal law. So much for the crapola from the left. Now, let me tell you what this is all costing you. You're going to love this. You're going to be so happy. You're going to go out and have like a milkshake. You're going to be so happy. French fries, McDonald's, who knows what. All right, here we go. Why don't we take, I know I have a lot of listeners in Arizona. Let's take Arizona. Now remember, put this in the context of all these Dems talking about how it's too expensive to spend $20 billion on a wall. So the fiscal burden of illegal aliens in Arizona, folks, is, number one, there's 630,700 illegal aliens, give or take, and they're U.S.-born children in Arizona. The United States taxpayers of Arizona pay $2.6 billion a year in state and local costs. The entire contribution, you remember the other crap that the left feeds us about how illegal aliens are critical to the economy and they pay much more than they pay much more in than we expend and la-di-da-di. I mean, once again, total crapola, and they know it. And the mainstream media, of course, doesn't call them out on it at all. In fact, I think I'm the only outlet right now that's going over this information with you. Illegal aliens in Arizona, where it costs $2.6 billion to just have them there, contributed $143 million in estimated tax revenues, which leaves a deficit of $2.4 billion for Arizona taxpayers to pay. Now, I can't do this on every state, but just to give you an example, education is $1.4 billion. Welfare is $86 million. Teaching English is $280 million. Health is $321 million. Justice, i.e. crime, is $340 million. And general, $153 million. That's how it breaks down for just that one state. Now, let's take a look at another one here. How about, let's see, I got a lot of listeners in Oklahoma. Let's take Oklahoma. Illegal immigration on Oklahoma. Now, Oklahoma has a relatively small population, and therefore a smaller population of illegal aliens. 85,000 illegal aliens live in Oklahoma. Nonetheless, those 85,000 illegal aliens cost Oklahoma $465 million a year and pay, listen to this, only a $23 million in taxes to the state, which leaves a deficit, by any math you want to employ, of $442 million, which the taxpayers of Oklahoma pick up. In Oklahoma, you can break down the costs of illegal aliens at $245 million for education, $53 million for health care, $37 million for justice and law enforcement, $46 million for public assistance, and $83 million for general government services. Let's take another state, shall we, where I have a lot of listeners. How about Wyoming? Home state, This home state, I'm going to be a home stater. The fiscal burden of illegal immigration on Wyoming. Now, Wyoming, of course, is the least populated state. It has the lowest total number of illegal aliens, 6,300 illegal aliens. I mean, virtually nothing. That's still 1% of the state's population, a little bit more, which is only 500,000. In Wyoming, even just those 6,300 illegal aliens cost $51 million a year and pay only an estimated $1.1 million in taxes, which leaves, and I'm kind of pissed off about this because guess what? I live in Wyoming. Leaves a burden of $49.9 million for Wyoming. Once again, it's broken down: $31.6 million education, healthcare, $4.3 million, justice and law enforcement, $5.5 million. Do you realize that's almost $1,000 per illegal alien for crimes, folks? Public assistance, $3.4 million, and general government services, $6.1 million. Let's pick another state, shall we? How about, where else do I have a bunch of listeners? Oh, California. I have a bunch of listeners in Northern California. Hello, Northern California. All right. I don't think I have that many in Southern California. I'm sure I don't have any in Hollywood. The fiscal burden of illegal immigration on Californians. Oh, this is just going to kill you. An estimated 4.1 million illegal aliens and their U.S.-born children live in sunny California with Jerry, baby. Jerry, our governor, yes, Mr. Mud Pie, accounting for at least 10.7% of the state's annual budget, and 10.7% of the state's population. Illegal aliens cost taxpayers in California, hold on to your hats, you Californians, $25.3 billion. $25.3 billion. Do you realize that illegal aliens cost California more than the gross domestic product of many of the countries on the planet Earth? Now, these illegal aliens that cost you guys out in California $25.3 billion pay only an estimated $3.5 billion in state taxes, which leaves us with, oh my God, it looks like to me almost $22 billion a year in deficits. In other words, folks, to put this in perspective, the $20 billion for the wall would be paid for by 1 year's savings in California net deficit relative to illegal aliens for 1 year. Now, do you know how many times over this wall would be paid for if you took the negatives on all these states? I mean, I've given you just a few here. Just a few. It's really interesting because these are such huge numbers. So for California, education is $14.4 billion. Healthcare, $4.02 billion. Of course, Jerry has them all on Obamacare. Justice and law enforcement, gee, these guys must be really peaceable, $4.44 billion. Dollars. That is for justice and law enforcement, in other words, crime. Public assistance, $792 million, and general government services, $1.6 billion. Let's pick another state. We've already paid for the wall and still have like $6, $7 billion in pocket change left. We've only been through four of the 50 states. Pretty amazing. How about, I know I have listeners in New York, upstate New York. Howdy to Jim and crew up there. Fiscal burden of illegal immigration on New York. This is another some whopping figures. 750,000 illegal aliens live in New York. They cost New Yorkers $9.5 billion per year. And this is one of the worst ratios of all the states. They only pay an estimated $192 million in taxes, which leaves a net deficit being carried by the poor folks in New York, Americans, of $9.3 billion, that's billion, folks, $1,000. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Let's go to our next state here. My computer is my computer must be gagging on these numbers too, because the little circle is spinning as it searches. All right. You know, they always tell you never take long pauses on the air. However, when you're dealing with satellite link-ups and all sorts of stuff, sometimes you just can't help it. How about New Mexico? Another western state. Lots of listeners down New Mexico way. The fiscal burden of illegal aliens in New Mexico. 140,000 illegal aliens, which is quite a few for a not-too-populated state. They cost New Mexico $717 million a year. They pay, hold on to these folks that take care of all their expenses and leave you with a profit. They pay $33.5 million, which leaves a net deficit for all you New Mexicans down there to pay for your illegal alien friends, $684 million a year. $684 million a year in little New Mexico. That's 125th of the wall right there in New Mexico. How about, what else can we take that a lot of people, Nebraska. Lots of listeners in Nebraska. All right, here we go. Here's the bad news for Nebraska, you Nebraska listeners. 50,400 illegal aliens who cost you $262 million a year and pay a whopping, hold on to this, $10.1 million a year in taxes. In other words, you spend 26 times more on their illegal alien butts than you get back in. And you spend $252 million a year out of your pockets for the pleasure of having illegal aliens in your state. Congratulations to my friends in Nebraska. How about North Carolina? I know I got a whole enclave of listeners out there in North Carolina. Where is North Carolina on the list? Where'd it go? North Dakota. North Carolina. Okay. North Carolina, hold on to your hats out there, listeners in North Carolina. 410,000 illegal aliens, and I think a bunch of them are voting folks, which is why those elections are so much closer. Illegal aliens cost you, $2.06 billion, and they pay $104 million. In other words, you are spending $20 to have them there more per dollar of tax you collect from them. Terrific. That leaves you with a burden out there in North Carolina of $1.6 billion to be host to your neighborhood illegal alien. Let's pick two more states. Let's see. How about Montana? I know I got a bunch of listeners in Montana. Okay. They actually have not very many illegal aliens, 5,000, but it still costs them $32 million. They only bring in $1 million in tax revenues. In other words, 32 to 1 cost to income. And that's $31 million for Montana to absorb on a net deficit basis relative to illegal aliens. And let's pick one more. How about Colorado? Got a bunch of listeners in Colorado, right down the road by Western standards, 3.5 hours. The fiscal burden of illegal immigration on Colorado. Oh, you guys have 195,000 illegal aliens. Gee, why don't you elect some more Democrats to your state legislature and by all means reelect John Hickenlooper, progressive that he is. I mean, absolutely. Denver, you are so screwing yourselves, you have no idea. Okay, West Slope, you're conservative, and you're getting so taken to the cleaners by the folks on the East Slope, you have no idea. So these 195,000 illegal aliens in Colorado cost you folks $1.45 billion, against which you have only collected $62 million. You're about 25 to 1 underwater. In fact, you are paying $1.4 billion a year out of your state income tax. Yes, that's right. $1.4 billion a year. For the pleasure, for the distinction, for the honor of having illegal 195,000 illegal aliens in your state. Terrific. Oh, my producer's saying give one more. Okay. How about Nevada? I got listeners out there in Nevada. I don't get a lot of emails from you guys. I don't know why that is, but we know that we have a lot of listeners, particularly on podcast out there. All right, Nevada has an estimated 200,000 illegal aliens. They cost Nevada taxpayers $1.2 billion a year. They only pay $63 million a year in taxes. And that leaves you with a burden out there in Nevada of $1.1 billion. I mean, these numbers are unbelievable. $1.1 billion. You know, folks, we have just about paid for the wall, even taking California out of the equation. I think I've only done 9 states, is it? I think 9. If you throw California in here, you could build the wall and have $20 billion savings in your pocket in the first year. And there's still 40 states I haven't talked to you about. Some of them quite populous. Some of them with lots of illegal aliens, like Florida. Like Pennsylvania, like Michigan. I know I got a bunch of listeners in Michigan. I'll tell you what. You listeners in Michigan, I'm going to give you your numbers too, and then we're going to call it quits. Hopefully this article, if it's not up this week, will definitely be up next week. I'll highlight it for you because you guys can click through and see every state, all broken down, how it's spent, why it's spent, da-da-da-da-da. So Michigan, you have 115,000 illegal aliens that cost you $929 million a year. You collect from them $32.3 million a year. That's almost 30 to 1, folks. You are spending $30 for every dollar of revenue you get in. And that leaves you with a burden out there in Michigan of $897 million. How do you like them immigration illegal alien apples, folks? Unbelievable. I mean, truly unbelievable. And they talk about the cost of the wall, right? Okay. Well, we got a few minutes left here. We ran out of time on the AM here about 17 minutes ago, but we got a few minutes left on the podcast. So I'm not going to be a downer because it's been, I think, a terrific week for Donald Trump. Gorsuch was approved. I had to send letters, well, I'm not sure my letters meant squat, but I did send personalized letters to 4 senators, Republican senators who had been waffling on going for the nuclear option. Susan Collins, of course, who, by the way, I believe voted against Gorsuch. You people in Maine, yeah, I think you can do better, don't you? John McCain, of course. Senator Flake, also from Arizona. And Bob Corker from Texas. I mean, please, Bob, get with it. Anyway, Gorsuch got approved. That was terrific. And let us hope that particularly now that the Republicans have created what's called the nuclear option, just as a little history lesson, it was always an up or down vote in the Senate, that is 51 votes to approve a nomination for a Supreme Court justice until Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And at that time, it went to this arcane 60-40 rule. The United States Constitution, don't listen to all this crap from the left. The United States Constitution allows for 51 vote approvals. The United States Constitution does not, let me repeat, does not require 60 votes, does not, I repeat, not specify that if there's a filibuster you need 60 votes to break or have cloture. None of that stuff. So really, the Senate has now been returned through Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell to the way the founders intended it to run, which is 51 senators decide. And let us hope against hope, that Donald Trump gets to appoint at least one, and hopefully two, and by a miracle, three more justices using the nuclear option. And that court will be done for years, folks. And the Democrats, if and when they ever regain power, they can use their nuclear option to replace their remaining two already liberal justices. How poetic is that? How poetic is that? All right, now, I don't want to meet, and by the way, he had the Syria strike, which I thought was brilliant on a whole bunch of different levels and respects. It's been talked about pretty well by the press the last day or two, so I'm not going to bore you. I'm not going to repeat stuff. That's not what I do. And he had the meeting with the Chinese president, which apparently went well. Donald Trump's had a hell of a week. I don't want to be a downer, but it is my job to bring you news that nobody else brings you, bring you dots that nobody else brings you, connect them, or give them to you so you can connect them, express my opinion on certain things, and make prognostications, which unfortunately proved to be correct 99% of the time. I really wish they weren't. You know, it does not please me that Susan Rice, Barry, Valerie, John Brennan, Ben Rhodes, Evelyn Farkas, it does not please me that they have committed treason. And I don't mean just on this surveillance and wire. I'm talking about across the board. I would much rather that we have true patriots, real Americans, who have America first as their interest, and the American people above everything as their interest, in power at any time, whether the Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. It pleases me not at all. But it is the news. And justice is required. So, I'm going to finish up this show with a little doom and gloom. And this is not to say it's going to happen, but I'm going to give you some facts here. You can connect the dots. You can take the steps that you think prudent to take for you and your family. Okay, number one, auto sales, I don't know if most of you know this, are down. Most of the auto sales over the past 5 or 6 years when auto sales have been booming is because of the funny money policies by the Fed. Type in zero interest, type in Federal Reserve in the search bar. You can listen to my shows on it. I've been talking about it for years. But this is all funny money, low interest rate printed money. And credit is the lifeblood of an economy. And in the case of car sales, subprime credit, kind of like the subprime mortgages, you know, back in 2008, where if you can fog a mirror, you'll get the loan. Subprime credit on cars now is in a 20% default rate and increasing. 20%. One out of every five car loans is in default and increasing. And that is beginning to drive down the prices of used cars by quite a bit, 4% in January alone. This is a first after 5 or 6 years. So be aware that shiny car out there in your driveway is going to be worth less and less over the coming months. And when these subprime loans, and we're talking over a trillion, I mean, this is not chicken feed. When the subprime loans start to really crater, well, you're going to see problems for the auto industry and problems in used car sales. So that's the first thing I wanted to bring to your attention. Secondly, as I discussed just a minute ago, this economy runs on credit. You borrow to expand your business, you borrow to employ more people, you borrow for your, you know, all the stuff. And I'm not just talking about personal consumer things like a car or a washing machine. I'm talking about business. And I've done other shows on this. Type in debt. You'll get a bunch of shows. Type in business debt. And you can refine it. Type in unfunded liabilities. You can refine it even further. But I've been talking about this stuff for 4 years. Well, look. There's been a steady credit expansion, i.e. people using money to grow their businesses, buy stuff, etc., for 7 years. It's all based on this funny money by the Fed, this, you know, 0.25% Fed funds rate that they've had in place, and the printing of money, and the buying by the Federal Reserve of United States bonds. I mean, it's like a big, it's not going to end well. The rate of credit growth, so that you know, has fallen 45% since late 2016. That is not good for business. Now, the jobs report just came out yesterday. It was 98,000 jobs. I have a feeling, I don't know, I have a feeling that the two are interconnected. In other words, the drop-off in demand for credit means expansion is not occurring, which means less jobs now. Everything works on a lag. Okay. The next thing I should bring to your attention. The stock market, as you know, has gone crazy. What you don't know is that a lot of these stocks, which are driving up the indexes, are bought on margins. And for those of you who don't know what margins are, that's basically when you borrow the money from your stockbroker to go out and buy stock. In other words, let's say a stock is $10 a share and you want to buy 100 shares. Okay? So it's $1,000 a stock you want to buy. You put in $100 and you borrow $900 from your broker to make the purchase because you're absolutely, positively convinced nothing can go wrong and it's going to go through the roof. Well, that's called margin. The problem with margin is that it artificially, and by the way, once again, you're getting into the low interest rate funny money, which is what's fueling this. The problem with margin is that when things turn around, and it doesn't take much, then the brokers make margin calls because the value of the stock has fallen below the amount they have lent by whatever ratio that particular brokerage uses. In which case, the guy who holds the margin, in other words, the stock trader, the consumer, whoever, has to come up with cash to pay the difference. That could be like a daily thing on margin. That's called a margin call. I'm sure you've heard the terminology. Generally, when margin debt reaches a peak, it signals a recession and a big pullback in the markets. Margin debt right now, this is hard data, is at the level that was last seen right at the top of the dot-com peak in 1999. Now, many of you may not remember, but that was a huge crash that caused a recession in 1999 and 2000. George Bush came into office and he was looking at a recession. And then, of course, he got the economy back on his feet with his tax cuts, and then came 9/11, which kind of knocked it off its feet again. And then in 2008, we had the mortgage recession. Well, we had a general huge recession, the Great Recession, based on subprime mortgage debt, which, by the way, is increasing again. And this time we have subprime auto debt. We have subprime student loan debt. Not good, folks. Not good. The other thing that I should bring to your attention along this line, consumer sentiment. Now, this is not hard data, numbers and dollars and, you know, math. This is people's emotions. That's what's being measured, whether they're optimistic, whether they're not. Consumer sentiment figures are right now at 17-year highs. Just so you know, consumer sentiment highs correspond with margin call highs and generally indicate a pullback. So that's two kind of little warnings out there for us. Consumers, folks, are not spending. While they may be very optimistic, they may feel good about Trump, etc., they ain't spending money. That is not a good sign. You've seen several articles that I've posted over the last, four or five weeks about all these retailers either severely constricting their operations or folding altogether. You know, this is all part and parcel of the same thing that's going on. So, anyway, keep these statistics in mind. Don't overextend yourself. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not going to tell you what to do. If it were me and I had a lot of profits in the stock market because of its amazing run since basically November 8th when Trump was elected, let me tell you an old adage my dad once told me. You can't never go broke making a profit. You might want to think about that. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. You have a great week, a safe week, and we'll talk to you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.